This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. In his book, The Polar Bear Expedition, James Carl Nelson writes that as the men of the Army's 339th Infantry Regiment trained at Camp Custer in 1918, their futures were being decided by President Woodrow Wilson in the White House, at London's 10 Downing Street, and at the Allied Supreme Council at Versailles outside of Paris. Nelson goes on to tell the story of soldiers, most of them from Michigan, who would be sent into Russia. North of Moscow, they would battle in frigid conditions beyond the end of World War I. James Carl Nelson's book, The Polar Bear Expedition, is subtitled The Heroes of America's Forgotten Invasion of Russia, 1918 and 1919. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Why exactly were Americans sent to Russia in the first place? What was the original intent of that mission?
Well, you have to understand that World War I, there were two fronts. There was the Western Front in France, and then the Eastern Front, where the Russians were pinning down the Germans and Austro-Hungarians. Since 1914, in late 1917, the Bolshevik Revolution occurred, and Vladimir Lenin made a separate peace with Germany and took Russia out of the war. That freed the Germans to take 80 divisions from the east, move them to the west, and some of those divisions became part of a massive onslaught that was launched March 21st, 1918. By June of 1918, the Germans were 35 miles from Paris. They had a great success, and so there was a true sense of peril among the Allied command on the Western Front, and they sought some way to relieve the pressure and cast about for ideas and come up with an intervention in northern Russia that would somehow recreate this Eastern Front, pin down the remaining forces that were there, maybe cause Germany to send more troops there. They wanted to do this by landing troops and making contact with this vast force of 40,000 to 80,000 men known as the Czech Legion, who had been prisoners of war of the Russians and were trying to get out of Russia via Vladivostok in the Far East. They wanted to turn them around. And they are also counting on local support from anti-Bolsheviks. It's quite an ambitious plan, considering they only landed a few thousand British soldiers initially and some French, Italians, even Poles. And so that was the main reason. And they begged and pleaded with President Woodrow Wilson to join in the party. And he put them off until mid-July 1918, when he agreed to send a single regiment, American regiment, to Archangel with the strict orders that they were only to guard stores. There was millions of dollars in material that had been gathering through the years at Archangel. He didn't want them as troops involved in any fighting with the Bolsheviks or to get involved in local politics or anything. So that is how and why the 339th Regiment, the Polar Bears, found themselves embarking at Archangel on September 5th, 1918.
So what went wrong? Because if people read your book, they know that is not the way this mission went. Things definitely changed. How so?
Well, you know, I think the main reason things changed was the British were running the show. And in the British mind, certainly in General Frederick Poole, who was the overall commander, he had the idea not only of recreating the Eastern Front. He wanted to undo the Communist Revolution. So his intent was to send this small Allied army, never more than 11,000 men, southeast to Kotlas, straight south to Vologda. We're talking 300-400 miles each, and taking this Czech army and basically marching on St. Petersburg and Moscow all before the snows fell. I mean, it was this hugely ambitious plan. And so what happened to the Americans as soon as they landed at Archangel, they were taken from their transports and hustled up to Dvina and down the railway line towards Vologda, and right away found themselves in combat with Bolshevik forces.
But as you tell us in Chapter 3 of your book, is called To Russia with Angst, there were problems even before troops got to Russia. Many people were already getting sick. And if we remember, this is the time of the great flu epidemic, and this was also sweeping the U.S. military at the time, correct?
Yeah, I was sweeping everybody. Well, what happened, these transports had serviced, I think, in the South Pacific, and they were flu-ridden, Spanish flu. And so men, yeah, as soon as they left England in the latter part of August of 1918, men started getting sick, some started dying. They landed at Archangel on September 5th, and through the next few weeks, about 70 men died from the flu. So that was the bad omen for what was going to happen later.
Were they prepared for the harsh winter that they were going to have to deal with north of Moscow?
Well, one of the reasons I think the regiment was selected was because, like you said, it was mostly Michigan men. There's also quite a big contingent of Wisconsin men. So they're well-versed in cold weather, not as cold as Russia. In Russia, we're talking at that time 50, 60, 70 below. They were issued wool. They were issued fur, overcoats, boots, mittens, hats. So in that vein, I don't think they were poorly supplied for the time of what was available for cold weather. They'd also been lectured by Sir Ernest Shackleton before they left England, the great Antarctic explorer, on what to expect in the Arctic. And in fact, they adopted his Shackleton boot that he had designed, sort of a muckluck, but they would find that the sole was far too shiny and slick that they could hardly walk in it, and some people wound up throwing out those boots away and walking around in eight pairs of wool socks. Weapon-wise, they were issued American-made Russian rifles. They had to turn in their Lee Enfields. They had millions of bullets for these Russian rifles at Archangel, and the men complained that the aim of these rifles was so poor that they could shoot around corners. So they never got used to that. They had very little artillery. They sent in a couple of Canadian batteries through the fall. And in general, you know, if the mission had stayed true that they were just going to guard stores, I think they would have been fine. But to be sent hundreds of miles into the Russian interior was a whole other matter.
Let's get back to some more of the book in a moment, but I want to ask you about pulling together this research. I mean, we're obviously well past the point of being able to talk to anyone who was actually there and part of the polar bear expedition. So how did you pull together the information that you have and then turn it into a book?
Luckily for me, there was kind of one-stop shopping at the Bentley Historical Library in Ann Arbor. They have a whole section devoted to the polar bears. They've been collecting memoirs, letters, diaries through the years, and they put a lot of it online. And they've got photos, just anything that they can get. And the polar bears are a very proud group. You know, they knew that they had gone through a very strange ordeal compared to the average man on the Western Front. So they were all very involved in keeping the memory of the polar bear expedition alive. There were other resources. Three of the men who came back, actually four, I should say, wrote three separate books, including Harry Costello, who wrote a book simply titled "Why Did We Go to Russia?" He just, because the men never really felt that they got a really good answer to what they were doing there and why they were dying and their comrades were dying there. So those were pretty detailed, good resources. Otherwise, I use whatever I can available, newspapers, Ancestry.com to track people down, other books through the years have been written on this. Use some of those as resources as well.
And you mentioned the idea of this being a strange war. You use that term quite often in this book, and you've written on military things before. How unique does this stand out in terms of maybe the lack of a truly defined mission that the people carrying it out could understand?
Well, I think that's the first problem. The mission changed, like you said, as soon as they landed at Archangel, and they never really understood the mission, especially. You know, the armistice occurred on the Western Front on November 11, 1918. And on that day, Company B of the 339th, stationed at Tulgas, 200 miles up the Dvina River, was attacked by hundreds and hundreds of Bolsheviks and spent 3 days fighting for their lives. And so once the armistice occurred and word of it got back to these guys, the question became, what are we still doing here? The war's over. The whole idea of recreating the Eastern Front was moot. The whole idea of having to guard stores from predations of the Germans or the Bolsheviks was moot. So there really was no, what was victory supposed to look like? And yet they had to hang on. That's when the fighting really started on Armistice Day. You know, the Allies thought, you know, once winter settles in, it'll be like civil war, north and south. They stop campaigning, we'll just wait for spring. But not in northern Russia. That's when the war picked up. The Bolsheviks strapped on their skis And it was a very growing army, and they became bolder and bolder and better soldiers, better equipped, and started really going after the Americans.
And that's one of the things that does stand out here as well, is, as you mentioned there, World War One is over by November 11th, 1918. That's Armistice Day. We now call Veterans Day. And yet here these soldiers still are in northern Russia. So is it inaccurate to call this part of World War One because of the fact that it went on into 1919?
I think it definitely is a part of World War One. I mean, it was... The original intent, the recreation of the Eastern Front, was very much a matter of for World War One, the Great War at the time. It is. It's a bizarre footnote to World War One, but it's definitely part of it.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. I'm speaking with James Carl Nelson. He's the author of The Polar Bear Expedition, The Heroes of America's Forgotten Invasion of Russia, 1918 and 1919. Was the training that the people received for first aid, for people, you know, helping the wounded, did that turn out to be another problem here, that that the soldiers were not properly trained in how to care for their wounded comrades on the battlefield?
Yeah, I mean, there was a medic, actually, Godfrey Anderson, who wrote that really they got very little training. They were pointed out a few parts, you know, they had to learn some bones, a little bit of bandage wrapping. It was on-the-job training for these guys. There were a few doctors sent along, too. But there again, it was, yeah, in general, the training of this regiment was poor. I mean, some men had begun training at Camp Custer in the fall of 1917, but others were showing up days away from when the regiment entrained for New York and then England. Then they did a little bit of further training in England as well. But it's hard to imagine how they could have really trained very well, especially under the conditions they were put in.
You write often here about some of the questioning by the troops of their mission. At one point, John Tornman of Kalamazoo wrote, that the officers forget all about the democracy that we were fighting for. Was it a common theme that you found, that people found themselves questioning exactly whether or not what they were doing really fit with the ideals that they were supposed to be there for?
Yeah, Tornman, he didn't like his commanding officers or his company commander. And I didn't see a lot of that in the memoirs of the other men so much. But yeah, there was you know, these guys were fighting under heroic conditions, incredible, just, you know, and for reasons they didn't even know, had no clue. I just went and watched They Shall Not Die, They Shall Not Grow Old yesterday, and those men had an esprit. They knew that they were fighting for. They're fighting to defeat Germany. Here, they didn't know what they were fighting for. But in general, there are a few instances of dissension. Some claimed it was mutiny, but I think that was overblown. But there's a sapping of morale, definitely among all the Allied forces as this long winter drew on.
You say that the talk of mutiny was overblown. Was there any real threat ever that there would have been mutiny among American troops?
I don't think so. There actually was blatant mutiny later in the spring of 1919. Among the Russians, the so-called SBALs, the Slavic British Allied League. There was one instance where they murdered all of their officers on the Dvina River. But I think, you know, there's a guy, Silver Parrish, who's a sergeant with Company B, and he's actually quite funny. He's wrote that he called himself the head of the Bolo Patrol. They were all Bolo sympathizers, he said, meaning Bolsheviks. There's another instance with Company I. I think they were unfairly tarnished. Just really a couple guys said, I don't want to go out. We're not going to go to the front. And it got totally overblown. And part of the reason it got overblown was because the British press picked up on it, and they were happy to make Americans look bad, you know, the jealousy between the forces during the war and after, who won the war, you know. I don't think there ever would have been anything like that. I hope, you know.
Why was it important for the American troops who did survive to eventually help organize the mission to go back and get the bodies of those who had perished in Russia and were buried there?
Well, I think that's a real tradition among many armies, is, you know, no one gets left behind, dead or alive. When they left Archangel finally in June of 1919. They took about 112 bodies of the 235 who had died there with them. And I think it was just gnawing at them that these guys were scattered in graves across this 400-mile front, basically laying where they had fallen. And when these men returned to the Detroit area, they formed the Polar Bear Association. And at their meetings, I'm sure they talked about it, and they ultimately raised some money, went back to Europe, gained access to Russia, and a party of them spread out, returned to the haunts where they had spent the winter of 1918, 1919, and retrieved 86 bodies and brought them home to the States. I think about half of those were claimed by relatives, and another half of them are scattered around the Polar Bear Monument at Whitechapel Cemetery in Troy. It's there last September. It's a very striking memorial to these guys.
And there are at least some men whose whereabouts were never accounted for, correct? We don't know what ultimately happened to them.
Yeah, there's about two dozen. A couple of those guys were prisoners. They might have died in a hospital in Vologda or Moscow. There's another prisoner who was Herbert Schroeder, Company B. He just disappeared, although someone said they saw him in Moscow, one of the other prisoners who returned. And, yeah, like in all wars, their men go missing. You know, they just die, fall, and nobody knows they're there. And then the unit leaves. And so, yeah, there's about two dozen still unaccounted for.
So one of the things you've talked about here is that idea that soldiers fight heroically, even though we find the mission difficult, if not impossible, to understand, and in this case, probably even misguided. When we have a century's worth of time, is it easier to separate those two things, what the soldiers did, how they fought, the bravery they exhibited, from the decisions made by policymakers about where soldiers end up being deployed?
Well, it's always not theirs to reason why, right? It's theirs to do it but die. And I mean, this unit, these guys did that for sure. You know, I mean, you know, even as it drew on, late March, early April, Company M in a place called Bolshie-Ozerki was attacked by 7,000 Bolshevik warriors. That's how big the Bolshevik army was getting. And they beat them off. They killed, wounded, took prisoner 2,000 Bolsheviks. So they were still fighting with great ardor, even though they didn't really know why. It was very frustrating for them, and I think that only adds to the sheen of their bravery and heroism, is that, you know, they fought, and if nothing else, they fought for the man next to them. They were there to do what they had to do.
So what can we say about how the Polar Bear Expedition may have changed the arc of relations between the United States and Russia over the next 100 years?
I think there's no direct line that can be drawn. I mean, you know, Khrushchev, when he was in the United States, the then Russian premier, mentioned that, you know, you Americans don't realize it, but, you know, Americans and Russians fought, and you invaded our country. I mean, it's very much in the Russian mind, where it's very little is known about it in the United States. You know, what I think the book does, it highlights that I think that people think the Russian-U.S. relations, the history of it, only goes back to, like, you know, World War II, when we were uneasy allies, and then boom comes the Cold War. But this pushes it back another, you know, 25-some years and shows maybe a glimmer of the mistrust where that between our two countries, where that comes from, where the origins are, because relations before this intervention with Russia had actually been quite good. No problems to speak of. Live and let live, pretty much. So I think nothing else to know that this expedition happened, misguided as it might have been, does illuminate a piece of history that I mean, I think Americans should know.
Yeah, and do you think that there's a reason why this has kind of stayed under the radar for American history, that a lot of people don't realize that this expedition actually happened in America? As you say, they know it in Russia, but maybe not so much in America. Do you think there's a good reason to explain that?
Well, in Russia, you know, the Bolsheviks used the repulsion of this intervention to great propaganda effect, to coalesce their support, say, look, we beat off these invaders. We're great, you know, and then they made sure that kids growing up knew about it. I think there was a sense of, you know, it wasn't really overall abject defeat, but it was a sense of maybe shame. I don't know, not amongst the soldiers, but among the men that sent them there. And there was just sort of an attitude once the 339th returned was kind of like, okay, let's just pretend that didn't happen. You know, let's just sweep that under the rug. The men themselves, you know, through the Polar Bear Association, kept the flame, the memory alive. But overall, it kind of faded from the American consciousness real quick. And I think, you know, the world in general was very war-weary at that point. So just kind of like didn't want to know about war anymore. And wasn't that much interest in this expedition, although it was covered in the newspapers, except for relatives and friends of these men who were sent there.
James Carl Nelson is the author of The Polar Bear Expedition, The Heroes of America's Forgotten Invasion of Russia, 1918 to 1919. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Links with more information on the book can be found at WMUK.org. WMUK's West Southwest podcast is produced by WMUK, the public radio station at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. You can find interviews at our website, WMUK.org, through the WMUK app, and by subscribing to WMUK's West Southwest podcast from Apple iTunes and by searching podcasts in Google Music. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.